how much am I living for what is my idea of what life should be? And how much am I living for like real aliveness for myself or for something bigger than myself?
Conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It's a wonderful biblical passage from Romans 12:2, and I find this more relevant today than ever before. Bom dia y buenos dias. Welcome to Eco Village Library. I'm Christopher Kinney, and this episode I am proud to bring to you with my good old friend Vera Frankel. And we originally met when I took a Eco Village course in Finhorn, Scotland, Eco Village. And she was actually one of my mentors. She was one of the facilitators of the course. And, you know, during that course, I've had my mind just blown to pieces and picked up back again and blown up to pieces again and put up back together again into a nicer mosaic. But not only just within the mind space, but within the emotional space, within just my view on the world, on what's possible, ways of living that I have never conceived of ever before until actually living it myself, feeling it for myself, and realizing, whoa, this could be done. And if everybody, or not everybody, but a lot more people living in a way that it's more enlivening for you and more ecologically harmonious with your surroundings, man, just imagine the kind of world that will be the predominant paradigm. And so I'm really excited to bring this episode to you guys with her, with our conversation, as we dive down and deep about inner transformation and getting into yourself, going within. Because it's not all about what's going on the outside, on what's going on out there, you know, what's going on in China with the virus, with what have you. It's all about what's going on within you. It's all about the thought ware of yourself. As Vera talks and elaborates more about during our conversations, it's about the thought ware. It's not about, you know, oh, the people do this, the people do that. Well, we're, you know, no, it's just dig deep inside yourself and be the change you want to see in the world. And also think of the old African proverb, as I think it was an African proverb, which goes by, if there is no enemy within, the enemies outside can do me no harm. So let's go ahead and dive into the conversation. And don't forget to please leave a review on whichever platform you're listening to this on, and leave a comment. Whether you like it or not, any feedback is greatly appreciated. So without further ado, let's dive in to our conversation with Vera Frankel and I. Let's begin. Okay, so Vera Frankel, welcome to the podcast, to Eco Village Library. I'm very happy to have you here. Before I just wanted to introduce you as best as I can, and correct me if I'm wrong. But first, we've met at the Eco Village Design course, or Applied Eco Village Design course at Finhorn Eco Village. That was about 2016. Since then, I've always considered you as a mentor, and you've surely taught me a whole lot, stuff that rang in my ears over the years since then, believe it or not. And I attribute a lot of the stuff I've learned to you and from what you've facilitated through the workshops we've done and the knowledge you've facilitated towards our way. And
I attribute to you a lot of inspiration. But now I see that you are doing some very awesome projects yourself. So could you tell us a little bit about your background, how you've gotten involved in the Eco Village movement, and then also later on how what you're doing now and what you're offering to the public now?
Yeah. Hi, Christopher. Hi, Christopher. I first started this kind of journey into sustainability and Eco Village movement because I was, let's say that I was kind of the sustainability Nazi in my family when I was a kid. I was given like a book of how to be an ecological consumer, and I read all these things. This is like back in the early 90s, late 80s, where CFCs were something that was going on, and they were separate from the problem of pollution, of water pollution. They were separate from the problem of having, you know, like too much metal cans lying around without, like, there was not a lot of recycling going on. And so I was always telling my parents, you know, turn off the lights, save water and things like that. So sustainability and the care for the planet, our planet, has always been in my awareness. And it wasn't until actually much later that I had in contact, I was in university studying applied physics for renewable energies engineering. And I was getting really turned off by the educational system, that it was so technical and so mental. And, you know, looking at how everyone around me was in a depression, really like with huge, like super high anxiety. And I was also myself, and I thought, like, this is not really sustainable, and it's not really, you know, giving me any inspiration for caring for the planet and caring for myself and my life. This cannot be it. This is cannot be the way, mm-hmm. by breaking people. And so I took a leap of faith, and I decided to just not work one summer, because I've been working all my life since I was young, and just to take a time to chill. And I found out through a series of synchronicities, I found out about Finhorn, the Eco Village and spiritual community. And I decided to go there. And it was like meeting my tribe, but meeting people who, like me, had a deep care for the planet. And also wanted to, and were responsible enough to create new ways of living. This was so exciting. I mean, the people that I met were not doing it for show. They were not doing it for getting credits. They were doing it because they really thought, gosh, if I really want to live a better life, I might as well start it. And so I stayed in Finhorn and, you know, started doing all these things that people do, like learning how to cook for a really long, like big amount of, large amount of people. I worked in the gardens. I worked in like house construction. But what I really wanted to do was work with people, mainly because of kind of my trauma on traditional education system, but partly because I could already know that, okay, so what is the most effective change that you can make? Well, we can, you know, you can like give fish to, what was that sentence is like? You can teach, you know, you can give a man, if a man is hungry, you can give him fish, or you can teach him how to fish himself. And so I thought, wow, okay, if I actually am involved in education and help change people's relationship to nature, relationship with themselves and the world, I think that's much more effective than just, you know, like building eco houses or designing a water catchment system, or even just living happily in an eco village. So I started kind of really shaping what I thought could be the kind of acupuncture points that could make amazing transformational ripples. And starting to see, like, how do I do that? came this amazing opportunity from Finhorn to work and co-facilitate the Eco-Village training, or the Applied Eco-Village Living, which was the title of the training that you went to.
Uh-huh.
I did that for a couple of years, and also the Eco-Village Design Education in Finhorn. So what I basically was doing there was weaving the different aspects of the ecological, the economic, cultural, and the social dimensions of what is sustainability, and make them kind of really relevant, not just theoretical, but really relevant to the experience of our classroom. And it was like I was a very big, like very good generalist. I knew a little bit of everything, and that's how I kind of wanted to go about, instead of like focusing on one thing.
Mm.
And then what started to happen was, after actually the Eco-Village, that training that you went to was canceled, and forever canceled in 2016.
Really?
We didn't have enough people signed in, and my co-facilitator, the amazing, legendary Craig Gibson,
was
dealing with cancer. And so the Finhorn Foundation decided to basically cancel the training forever. And that was a really hard decision for me, because that was my soul work. And I got really affected. I was like, okay, so this is really what I wanted to do. What else can be there for me? And what I realized is the parts of the Applied Eco-Village Living that I liked doing were the parts of getting people in touch with themselves and the world to really experience what was being taught, and those kind of really kind of like the rituals, the practices, the learning that happens in between the formal teaching settings. And so I found this really amazing, like super amazing work called Possibility Management that was doing exactly that, basically. So since then, I've been super turned on. It just totally matches everything that I was already doing, but gives it a huge amount of clarity, and works on deconstructing the memes and the patterns and the behaviors in each individual to be able to build a different self, a different society and everything.
And Possibility Management, are they a separate organization that you've come across with? Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. I met Possibility Management. So I met Clinton Callahan, the person who originated Possibility Management, the Eco-Village movement. He had been attending the Eco-Village conference in Europe for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. And through different friends that had been attending these conferences, and the effect, the actual effect that it had on their lives was so palpable and so clear that I was ready to kind of, like, I was really curious. For a person who has been in Finhorn, which has been considered kind of like the mecca of new age inner outer transformation of Europe, and been living there for, you know, by then it was like 7 years, any framework that was good eventually found its way to Finhorn. So I was pretty, not jaded, but kind of saturated with different worldviews, different frameworks. Mm-hmm. When I saw that happening, that change happening in my friends, I had like a triple take, you know. It was clear they had become so much more responsible, so much more empathic, so much more like active agents in the world. And I got curious. So I went in to do the the expand the box training, which is the basic training. So this is, it is a separate organization. It's a group of trainers in a trainer guild that deliver these transformational trainings that help people to really deconstruct parts of themselves and to have more choice. And it's a context based on radical responsibility, which is a concept that it's a principle that I don't really see happening even in the most I don't know, like strong established organizational structures of regenerative cultures. Like responsibility is kind of this dirty word that people associate with blame and burden. And the way that I understood responsibility and the way that possibility management understands or speaks about responsibility was so much more freeing and creating. So that really turned me on.
So interesting.
Tell me.
So for like, let's say I have nothing, no experience or no knowledge about what any of this is about, but I'm somewhat attracted to it. And I say, you know, I go to your website and it's like, oh, you know, expand the box training. I like to do this. Oh, sign me up. And so what should I expect from that point on once I sign up? Could you explain a little bit more about how that process works?
Yeah. Well, think about it this way. When a lot of the times when people are trying to create change, effective change in the world, they're trying to get new results, right? They're trying to get results from something. From their lives, from their projects, organizations. But often people try to get new results without changing a lot of their behavior or just applying a method, but something hasn't really changed deeply in themselves. It's like trying to do the same, like having the same types of organizations, having the same type of culture, and expecting that that culture produces different results.
Yeah.
So for getting new results, you need new behaviors. And for new behaviors to happen, you need to have new choices to choose from. If you don't see new choices of action, it's really hard to do a different choice, a different behavior. So the new choices to choose from, they come from different, like, new ways of seeing the world. So new, because we don't interact with the world directly as it is. We interact with the world through the maps and the stories we have about the world.
Totally.
So, yeah. Exactly. So we're trying to, like, a lot of people are trying to change the world, and it's like, because that this is how the world is, and why is it not changing? And it's actually, okay, we need to change the stories and the maps that we have about the world. So yes. Remember at some point, you know, like we were taught in history class that at some point the world was flat for us. Right? There was this common, like in Europe, the world is flat. There was a map of the world. And it was great that we had this map, because before we had this map, there was no map of the world. And the map, the first map of the world, whoever made it, maybe different cultures made different maps for sure. I'm speaking mostly from the European perspective, because I come from the European perspective. And the processes, the healing and the transformative processes that I deal with are not initiations that are appropriated from different cultures. There are contexts that come from the need from the modern culture to evolve out of the capitalist, competitive, scarce culture that we live in. So it's not, that's why I'm coming from the European perspective. There was this map of the world, and it was great because it would tell you where you're at, where, you know, like your enemies are at, where there's like a dragon, where you know, where's the treasure, whatever, you know. So it would tell you where you are and where the danger was. But there was a problem with this map, because what would happen when you would sail out into the end of the world? What could happen?
You'll fall off.
Yeah, exactly. This was the thing, like you'd fall off and die. So that's why people discovered, when they were discovering new things, it was like quite close to home. It was, you know, a lot of people didn't even leave their safe zone. So there was a certain point, there was this man that made a new proposal of a map, right? He said, actually, the world isn't flat. The world is round. And it was, this was so hard for people to get that he was prosecuted, right? I mean, it was so dangerous to think that the world wasn't flat, the world was round. And at some point, okay, everyone kind of adopted this. I know we're having a revival of the flat earth thing, but there was a, there was this consensus of, okay, the world is round. And what did this new map of the world gave us? It gave us more possibilities. You know, you suddenly could sail far away from known land and you would not fall off and die. I mean, you could be, you know, from a European perspective, you could be in Australia and not fall off and die because it's that the world isn't flat. But the thing is that did the world actually change? No, the world didn't change. It was the same world of the flat world, but the map changed and it gave us more possibilities. We suddenly could go further. We could explore different worlds that were unknown to us. So we had more possibilities with a different map, and the actual reality didn't shift. So what happened was there was an upgrade of the map, because you actually didn't lose any of the information of the flat world map, right? So you still, in the new map, you still knew where the good guys were, where the enemies were, where the resources were at. So you still had all of the information from the old map, but you just got more options. So this is what we do in possibility management. We basically upgrade the thought maps, the maps of what we think the world is, what we think we are, what we think our relationship with the world is, to give more options to choose from. The thing is that is scary for a lot of people is that changing the way that we see ourselves in the world does require decision and requires a shift in our lives. And change is always a little bit scary. Just the same way as the change was scary for a lot of people from going from the flat world map to the round world map. So it requires a shift, a personal shift. So this work for me is truly revolutionary because of two things. One, it's accessible. It's accessible because it really depends on an individual's choice, regardless of the circumstances. And it's revolutionary because it is not a moralist system, because it really relies on the person's authentic choice of what's happening in them and how they choose to see the world and how that affects how that choice of the map that you're using affects the results of your actions. So what happens is when people get to the point of possibility management, they get the point of responsibility. And for me, I see possibility as an amazing gift and a privilege. And I equate it to freedom. Like if I'm responsible for my life, radically responsible for everything that happens in my life, then not only I can't blame anyone or anything else for anything that happens, but I don't have to wait for anyone or anything.
Exactly. It's liberating.
So liberating. And so, yeah. So a lot of people who are still benefiting from blaming others and, you know, outsourcing responsibility, they usually find that shift a bit more complicated. And, you know, and I think that's normal. And I think it's very needed. And I think people are getting to this point where, okay, blaming actually doesn't change anything. You know, we have a saying that is, who we blame, we empower. So how about ourselves? Exactly. Yeah, so it's a little bit of possibility management for you.
Oh, man, you're just opening up the rabbit hole. I don't know where to start next. But I want to bring up a quote that you wrote on your latest article about upgrading our thoughtware. I identified particularly with this because I felt myself in this situation when you said, probably ever since you were 18 years old, you were longing for authentic adulthood thoughtware upgrade initiations. And I felt that myself. I remember clearly, like 18 years old, I'm like, oh man, I have a glimpse of the kind of person I want to be good and do good and be mature. But I, you know, being immature in that time, I didn't know exactly how to cross that step. And so being here in the culture of the United States, we have a funneling towards the industrial military complex. And so I've got funneled into being inspired to go into like the military academies and whatnot, because it just like seems so intense. And so I think that artificially replace that longing for that trueness. And until then, where I really had to decide for myself that this was not the calling that I had previously imagined for myself earlier. Like this kind of seemed something that I just wasn't expecting. And I knew the authenticity and the depthness was not there. And I don't know, I really like that passage from your article. And my question then would be, do you believe that a lot of people are starting to get more and more of that initial inkling?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because, you know, when I grew up in a very kind of alternative family, and still, you know, I still had a very normal life. I didn't know anything about eco-villages and other ways of living. It was kind of like I was having two lives. One that was kind of very esoteric, because my parents were very were into philosophy and magic and stuff. And I had to kind of reconciliate that with going to school with my friends in high school, normal friends. I think it's really like the reason why you are pulled into the military and other young people are pulled into the military is because we have in all of us this hunger and longing to serve. So what the military does is gives a false sense of purpose, of service. And, you know, it gives a very clear direction. You don't have to do like a lot of choices. You're being trained. There's camaraderie. There's a kind of a sense of community and a sense of service. So it kind of takes a lot of boxes when you don't know what you really want. And you don't see the alternatives available.
And it was very hard to leave that situation, particularly because everything was so set. Like when I first came to the military camp, I was like, okay, that's all the thinking I have to do for my own life. I'm just going to let the train take me from here. And when I decided to leave, it was almost like leaving Pluto's cave. You know what I'm saying? Like people were just like, what? You're going to do what? How are you going to get a job? What are you going to do? You know, this is the only way. What are you talking? You're crazy. You're going to go to university and consider getting debt? What are you doing? And I felt like I was in Pluto's cave, but I was like, I don't know, man. I just have this inkling that I got to get out of here. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
No, it's great. It is so scary, because life and what modern culture does is basically put people in schooling and which is devoid of encouragement to really develop these inklings and intuitions and inner knowings that we have into more of an empowered inkling and knowings. And so when people go to school in modern culture, it's a huge programming already to follow, already to, this is what the world is and this is how it is. And this is what your place is in all of it. You're a producer, you're a consumer. And by the time, even if we don't go to university, but by the time we leave whatever mandatory schooling there is, we have already a shape about what the world is. But not only that, it's even before going to school, we already have a certain thoughtware. Because even before going to school, we already knew how some things were of the world, like who are we, what's our parents, that school is a cool thing, is a good thing. You know, there's already thoughtware that we've been handed down that it keeps us in a survival mode, in authentic mode, like a way and totally disconnected with our feelings. In fact, the thoughtware of modern culture is that feel emotions and feelings is actually bad. It's not okay. You know, like anger is considered mostly aggressive and dangerous, and sadness, and it's like it's weak, only for women, you know, like a patriarchal thought where fear is also, you know, it's non-productive, it's weak. But even joy is seen, you know, it's okay, a little bit of joy, but don't be joyful all the time, because people are not seen as credible and serious if they are like have high joy in their lives, you know. There's this kind of blend in, don't stand out. So one of the biggest things of modern culture is exactly to keep us away from us being the source of our own lives. And so it really teaches each individual to let go of their autonomy, let go of their authorship, their agency, and follow the directives so that you can be safe. So that military is just one of the multiple avenues that modern culture has to really incite you to give your power and your authority away. Because, you know, university can be another one, schooling can be another one, going into the job world so that the economy can grow is another one. Because what if you don't want the economy to grow? What if you don't want to give money to a nuclear weaponry? What if you want to do something else? You know, like so many countries don't allow actually its citizens to have agency on where the money of the taxes go. And so, so does it make sense to even, you know, like to even follow this, like, yeah, what we want is this, the story of the government or the story of prosperity according to the modern culture, you know. And prosperity for modern culture means exploitation of the natural world, is seeing water, land, sun as a resource, not even as a being, you know, or exploiting other people, exploiting First Nations or Indigenous peoples, and exploiting not just Indigenous peoples, but pretty much everyone. You know, you're seen as a worker and a producer, not as a person or a consciousness, a multidimensional consciousness capable of creating amazing things. You know, and people's intellects can be more or less developed, but we are so much more than our minds and have so many other capacities and capabilities. But it's, of course, it's super beneficial for a culture of production, of profit, of this kind of development to continue, because you wouldn't have, you know, you can only do that if you have disempowered individuals who are willing to follow. So what the military did and what the modern culture does is takes that need, that basic longing for service and contribution from a young person, rips them or distances them from their own source of power and authority and their own inner resources, like feelings, like our center, like our power of choice, like our power of choice to upgrade our own thoughtware, and just basically transforms each person as a follower and calls that a citizen. So really what I, you know, it might sound a little bit radical, but once people start looking at how much power they actually have, you know, regardless of the circumstances, once you start freeing yourself from the ideas, the stories, all the limitations that you think you have, that you can't do something, and you see, actually, this is just BS. This is basically not real. This is just the story that I have about myself and the world. And you start experiencing the lack of grounded truth in it, then you can see, like, oh my God, actually, we can do so much more. Because, you know, sometimes people talk about overpopulation, and if the, you know, our planet has a problem of overpopulation. Mm-hmm. You know, just think about these 7 billion people instead of all doing what they're doing right now, just being really alive and contributing back to the ecological systems. As fast as we are at the moment harvesting and eating away our planet, we would be fast, like doing it as fast, but putting it back. And this potential, you know, we don't even know what could happen, but the potential is there. And this is my passion, because I really, you know, like I think we all know that a better thing is possible. We don't know what it is. And we are so, like, people are so accustomed to having safe, you know, like safe steps to step on. But the thing is that those safe steps were steps that have been carefully curated and designed to make you feel safe so that you don't have to think for yourself. So it does require possibility management and these kind of pioneer edge working. We call it edge work because it's working on the edge of what normal traditional settings work. You work on the edge into pioneering what else is possible besides what's in the menu. And you have loads of people that do that in the world in different areas. And it requires a certain courage. It requires a certain fear, being connected with your fear about, I don't know if this is going to work, or I don't know how I'm going to do this, and then still deciding to be there and doing it because, okay, I know that what I'm seeing around me is not working. It definitely doesn't work for me. So I can just spend all the rest of my life trying to make it fit me, or I can just use all of this energy already creating something totally different. And these are the people. I know that there's a whole process, bridge building, to get a person who's really, you know, deeply immersed in surviving in the current modern culture possible, because people are, they noticed. And so to answer a little bit of your question, do you think that people are in touch with their inklings that something needs to change? I think everyone, every single human being in this world can feel the pain of how they're living within the planet ecosystem, but also with each other and also in their lives. You know, you have so many people working in modern slavery, you know, more than 9-to-5 work, busting their ass to like make money so that they can have a certain lifestyle. And then so they're a bit hostage of this. And I know that they feel pain. And so how can people survive in those systems? They do it by numbing themselves. So we have the largest entertainment industries in the world that ever we had before. You know, it's entertainment, it's alcohol, it's anything that can really make us forget that we actually are not really nourished by the life that we are living. So you took the courage of really feeling that dissatisfaction, that lack of nourishment. And I think if someone really allows themselves to feel, and they can, it's like the first step to looking for, okay, what else is possible? And I know that possibility management work is not like the only one that does this. And it's also not the most globally known kind of context. And there's more and more cultural creatives, people who are taking more responsibility and creating different things so that different societies, different ways of relating with each other, with nature. You know, you have so many more NGOs than ever before. Eco Village Movement, Extinction Rebellion. You have so many more people wanting to protect and being visible about that, that I think is getting, it's getting more and more likely that especially the young people when they see, I don't know if this is what I want, they can have access to mm-hmm. new options. And this is also why we're in possibility management, we're making all of the a lot of the contact and the thoughtwares totally available and free online, because possibility management is a copyleft framework. So what you're doing, what we're developing is free, can be stolen, used. You can teach that and share that and make money with it. Use it in every context, because what we want is liberation, basically, and the people that have more options. So.
And that's possibility management. Like, if I were to just Google possibility management, or is it known as something else? Okay.
Yeah, the official website is possibilitymanagement.org.
Okay.
And then we're doing this, putting all of the content in the web with a game, like an online and offline multiplayer game.
I saw that. I was very curious. Yeah. So tell me about this game. Yeah. What is it?
Wow. Do you remember how, there was this thing called Dungeons and Dragons?
Yeah.
A long time ago. There was the interesting thing with role-playing games is that there was a lot of choice. It wasn't just random dice or cards that would affect the course of the game. So StartOver.xyz is an online and offline multiplayer game that is basically you choose your path.
Whoa. And
you go and you hit, you can find the game through multiple portals, multiple websites, and websites are connected to other websites, making a huge network of different doors that you can choose to go through. And you can play it with friends and do it together and read one of the websites that gives you multiple distinctions. But the treasure is actually doing the experiments, because when you read, you get a certain amount of information only on your intellectual body, but it's not until you really practice that your mind and the rest of your bodies will actually realize that this can be really possible. One thing is reading about cool things, and another one is when you go about in your life and you live as if that that idea could work, and then it works and it can totally change your life.
Yeah, it's just like that Dalai Lama quote, which speaks of the three different levels of understanding, which one is through learning and studying as, a level one, and then an understanding developed as a result of more reflection, deep reflection, contemplation as level two, and then the level three being, experience, meditative experience, perhaps.
Right. So there's experiments, so you don't have to, you don't have to commit all your life to do this or that. It's just like, okay, do you want to know if it works? There's only one way to know if it works. The proof is in the pudding. Go try it out and share the results. So this is the thing. Another cool thing about possibility management is that it's a research field. So it's in constant development and updating and upgrading. And we want more people to be part of. It's exciting. And I have to say that because it's constantly upgrading and updating, the start over game is also not finished, because there's going to be some sites that have a couple of information and more is going to come soon. Others that are just being started. And instead of just launching something kind of with the perfectionism, like, okay, this is done, work with it, we are updating it as we go.
Nice.
Every day there's a team of at least 5 people constantly putting it out there and making it more usable, friendly, and we want more people to use it and give us feedback.
Well, come in, I'll start using it.
Cool.
Okay, so when we talk about this, like, the majority of the world, at least from my perception, is stuck in this old thought where built for us, I guess you could say, and we have this other side of the paradigm starting to wake up through all the awesome work being done through possibility management and so on. But the critical mass, it's very easy to be pessimistic, like, oh my God, you know, there's just too many people on this old train of thought. How do you foresee that shift taking place? Do you think that a crisis would really have to be the trigger, or could you see that happening without there being a crisis to push everybody over to the other side?
Well, it depends on what you're counting as a crisis, because there's so many people in the planet already that would consider what's happening right now a crisis.
I guess, for example, like I'm coming from a North American perspective, for example, the majority, the biggest generational population is the baby boomers who are retiring, and a lot of them are counting on pensions. But as we know, there's a big pension crisis where the pensions are not actually there. They've been stolen. And so when people retiring from this baby boomer generation, realizing that all that they worked for and that they've been promised is not there, especially with that generation having one of the most powerful purchasing powers in the world, I wonder if maybe a shift like that would be something that kind of pushes everybody over to the edge, where I don't know. That's just an example I could think of on the top of my head. I'm sure there's millions of others, but I wonder if that's what has to come, just a crisis in many different forms to, you know, give that choice to people, whether they realize their whole life was a lie, or that portion of their life was a lie, and they got this choice to wake up. I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't know. Does it have to be that way, or could somebody choose this other way of thinking, this new thought, where without having to be pushed so harshly?
Yeah, it's interesting, but you know, it's sometimes. My experience is that with older generations, or when people tend to have more, a little bit more crystallization on their worldview, because they have so much more to lose by leaving this system of patriarchal imperial domination, right? So it's there a lot of their lives, if a lot of their lives is based around the thoughtware of modern culture, it's going to be very hard for them to change, because they benefit so much, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. A change in the consequences of that thoughtware, like you said, like if they suddenly get no pension, would that be enough for them to change? For me, yes, that could happen, but a more interesting question for me is that. And noticing also patterns around the world is that actually, even when pensions drop, and even when the more overt benefits of playing the same system, people are still so afraid of, because they're so invested in the system, they have no idea what else is possible, that it doesn't necessarily make them change. You know, you have, for kind of a revolution that you're talking about, things need to be so, so bad that people are desperate. And there is a danger of people being really desperate, which because, you know, like a lot of violence and militarism is involved, people have a lot less to lose, but they also, it's not really transitioning by design, by choice, is kind of, if I could, it's not also not necessarily taking more responsibility, because it's also saying, well, if I could, I would just live this lifestyle until I die. Mm-hmm. But because I can't, I'm going to have to do something about it. Which is, it's kind of, if the generation, let's say the millennials, are the millennials doing it differently because they really recognize that what the baby boomers and the X generation were doing doesn't work, or are they doing it because they're pissed off that they can't do the same? You know, would they do the same if things weren't messed up? So for me, the more interesting conversation is, how much am I living for what is my idea of what life should be? And how much am I living for, like, real aliveness for myself, or for something bigger than myself? If I know, you know, like, I think a lot of people do have that. And I don't know if it's, I can't say if it's like the majority of people. But I remember talking with a lot of kids when I was a kid and being a teenager and going to like young adulthood, everybody would like say, duh, like it's obvious that, you know, that no one wants to live in an, you know, like work in a job 9 to 5 and only get to have some, right? It was just so obvious. Not even our parents wanted it, but it was really seemed like, okay, fuck it. I'm just going to do something different. So it's, for me, it's really about changing what are we living for? Like, what is the point of what we're doing? Is it just comfort? Is it safety? Or can we dare to ask more of our own lives? That is a very personal choice to do. My experience in helping people has led me to say that it isn't until it hurts that people really do the shift. Because when it doesn't hurt so much, they are still benefiting a great deal.
Yeah.
How things are. So it's really allowing people to feel, because even the people who are benefiting a great deal, they can still feel. And because there isn't a medium, there isn't a platform, there isn't we're not educated or trained to feel consciously, to feel with each other and be accountable and responsible for our own feelings. We don't have, you know, we go to school, people go to school for decades sometimes and learn about complex systems, mathematics, like sciences. But what about how to deal with grief or how to deal with disappointment? And what do I do with anger, and how do I do with conflict? The so-called soft skills that are actually essential skills for any kind of collaboration, any kind of work, we are not trained in that. And so, because if we were, and this is what I think needs to happen, is having more training, more literacy, more competence in accessing how we feel, because this will just really get people to realize, to like, okay, I can't stop this any longer. I do really feel unhappy with my life. I really do want to make a change. I really, and bring that bridge to new choices, make those new choices more available, more seen. So yeah, this is, and my goal, or one of my goals, or one of my wishes is to train as many people as I can in this, so that they can help each other. So that if there's a person somewhere that someone knows that is going through something and they're ripe and ready to make a shift in their lives, they don't go like, but there's no other option.
Yeah.
Really see like, huh, there was this guy that someone told me about that they're doing something cool, that it's different. I mean, might be a bit weird, but I could give it a shot, you know, to make it a little bit more available.
It's all, speaking of like, you know, getting rid of your anger, for example, I noticed that you have what's called Rage Club. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Our rage is actually really powerful. When we learn how to feel rage consciously and we do it responsibly, our anger is absolutely necessary for us to work with our boundaries, you know, to be able to say no. You know, if you can't say no, your yes is a lie. So what is the message that we're doing in our dealings and what we're saying to the world when we say yes? So because if we can't say no, our yes is basically worthless. So we need the anger to be able to set a boundary, to be able to change our minds, to be able to protect, to take a stand for something. Mm-hmm. We need our anger to advocate for ourselves, to be assertive, to change things. But if we live in a world where our thoughtware says anger is dangerous, anger, we shouldn't feel it, we lose a huge inner resource of agency and assertiveness. And clarity, because anger gives it like an experiential clarity as well. If you come to one of my trainings or Rage Clubs, you will experience this. That's like, if you go beyond seeing anger as a good or bad thing, you can really experience in your body a certain clarity of what is important to you. Because what you're mad about is what you care about.
Interesting.
And feelings like anger and sadness, fear and joy, feelings are not good nor bad. They are neutral of judgment, and they're just full of energy and information for you to deal with life. So the energy that anger brings is an energy of action. So if you are literate about your anger, and if you are in contact and in touch with your anger, you can learn to be more responsible with your anger. And then you can use it as a tool. You can use it as a resource to say the thing that needs to be said in that moment, to support a friend who's being oppressed or harassed in the street, or because you are ready. You won't feel that it's not okay, that you don't have this, and they're like hesitant or embarrassed for being angry. So if you change the thought aware about anger. And the other three feelings that I was mentioning, sadness, fear, and joy, also have totally unique energies to power you. It's like rocket fuel for you to live your life. You know, with sadness, it's super important to grieve. For transformation, for letting go. It's super important for listening, for your listening skills. You know, like try to listen with anger and try to listen with sadness, and you'll get totally different qualities of listening. So it's about upgrading what we think about these things, and then practice them, like really get more competent and so that we have choice about it.
Okay, so what do you say in the instance that I get angry in the moment? For example, I'm just going about my day, and then somebody calls me, you know, hey, poopy pants. I'm just like, what do you suggest in moments like this when we feel that surge of anger? What do we do?
Not wanting to have the anger training right now with you, it's more because it's more of an experiential thing.
Totally.
Less of a mental thing. There are, in possibility management, we distinguish feelings from emotions. Basically, the feelings are things that happen in the now, in the moment. They have no story attached. You use feelings to deal with something. So for example, if you're out in the street and you're needing to catch a bus, and you're like walking along your way, and then you see your bus heading, and it's like the bus is early or whatever, or you're late, you need to make a decision like right then and there to either catch it or let it go. If you use your anger, you just start running without thinking, and you catch it. You know, let's say that you catch it. So that was a very short and use of your anger in that moment. You used it, you decided, you acted, you got it, right? So if you were in like not using your anger, and you could be like in your sadness, and you're like, oh, it's late, oh my God, like, damn it, I'm always late, you know? And so that is the kind of energy that wouldn't get you to catch the bus. So the feelings are really to deal with the things in the moment. The emotions, the way that we distinguish feelings and emotions is that feelings last for like 3 minutes. You feel it, you deal with the thing that needs to be dealt with, and it just dissipates. You go into the next thing. But an emotion is like when the feeling about something stays for longer than 3 minutes. Sometimes it stays for hours. Sometimes it stays for days. Sometimes it stays for months. Some people have the same feelings or the same emotions actually from like generations, you know, like so two families were enemies, you know, like, and the youngest people in the family have these emotions too, but they're actually not theirs. It's from the whole family. So they're still carrying this emotional baggage with them. So what are feelings for? Feelings are to deal with things. But what are emotions for? Well, emotions are to heal things. So every time we have an emotion, which could be something from the past usually, or even from like not even ours, from someone else, it's actually a gateway for healing something, for a part of ourselves that is ready to kind of come out and be seen. So have you ever been in like a situation where, I don't know, like you had an interaction with someone and you left that interaction and you stayed kind of like angry at that person or having an inner dialogue?
Right?
So probably you have experienced that kind of energy, exactly that kind of energy before. Mm. It's like when you're talking to someone and someone has just this huge reaction that has kind of like almost nothing to do with that moment. It's a very simple thing, but that person's like really reacting a lot, because what that person or what you would be, if you're experiencing an emotion, you'd be experiencing something that is not from that moment, but that moment kind of activated the memory of all of the times that a similar thing happened. And so that emotion, you know, if you try to deal with it, it will still come back. So you'll have emotions, any emotion that you experience for more than 3 minutes, it's an emotion. It's a gateway. You can go through a healing process, an emotional healing process. You can do an initiation. Some are very kind of short and super powerful things that we can do. And some are, you know, go in layers, because there's some things called traumas and things that have to, you know, be revisited. But it's a good distinction to have, and such a simple way of distinguishing, which is the amount of time that it takes. And if we start having these kind of distinctions and these this clarity about what we are feeling and what's our inner world like, then we have more options about it. Mm. So if you're like next to someone and you're having interaction, and then suddenly you feel like angry about something, or really sad, or really scared about something, and it's not going away, you can actually tell that person, hey, I'm having an emotion right now, and because it's going for a long time, it tells me that it has nothing to do with you right now. So you can choose. I could say, I can't deal with this. You know, like, I'm going to go back, talk to a friend, talk to a coach, whatever, talk to Bear, and then come back to you when I've dealt with this, so that I can be present with you. You know, how much conflict and how much our relationships would be different.
Oh yeah, just imagine the quality of our day-to-day interactions by everyone just making that simple conscious awareness. Well, hey, Vera, it's been an hour, and I could sit here asking you millions of more questions. I always feel like I always learn something new every time I talk to you. You know, you are so wise. You've come with a great deal of experiences and very important life lessons. I'd love for us to do this again sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to talk more about this. Thank you, Christopher, for the invitation. I look forward to another podcast with you.
Yeah, thank you. Likewise.
Okay.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, folks. That is our conversation. If you like this, please write a review on whatever platform you listen to this on, and we'll make it happen again. And any requests on any future podcast episodes that you'd like to see, again, you can write us an email at ecovillagelibrary@gmail.com, or leave a review, whatever your jam is. And speaking of jams, why not finish this episode with the jams of my own brother, Michael Kinney, with his inspired beats. Much love. Until next time.